This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeline Tien. Narrated by Angela Lin. Part 1. There are a thousand ways to live. Just how many do the two of us know? Zhang Wei, the ancient ship. Of all the scenes that crowded the cave walls, the richest and most intricate were those of paradise. Colin Thubron, Shadow of the Silk Road. Chapter 1. In a single year, my father left us twice. The first time to end his marriage, and the second when he took his own life. That year, 1989, my mother flew to Hong Kong and laid my father to rest in a cemetery near the Chinese border. Afterwards, distraught, she rushed home to Vancouver, where I had been alone. I was 10 years old. Here's what I remember. My father has a handsome, ageless face. He is a kind but melancholy man. He wears glasses that have no frames, and the lenses give the impression of hovering just before him. The thinnest of curtains. His eyes, dark brown, are guarded and unsure. He's only 39 years old. My father's name was Jiang Kai, and he was born in a small village outside of Changsha. Later on, when I learned my father had been a renowned concert pianist in China, I thought of the way his fingers tapped the kitchen table, how they pattered across countertops and along my mother's soft arms all the way to her fingertips, driving her crazy and me into fits of glee. He gave me my Chinese name, Jiang Liling, and my English one, Marie Jiang. When he died, I was only a child, and the few memories I possessed, however fractional, however inaccurate, were all I had of him. I've never let them go. In my 20s, in the difficult years after both my parents had passed away, I gave my life wholeheartedly to numbers. Observation, conjecture, logic, and proof, the tools we mathematicians have not only to interpret, but simply to describe the world. For the last decade, I have been a professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Numbers have allowed me to move between the unimaginably large and the magnificently small, to live an existence away from my parents, their affairs and unrequited dreams, and, I used to think, my own. Some years ago, in 2010, while walking in Vancouver's Chinatown, I passed a store selling DVDs. I remember that it was pouring rain and the sidewalks were empty. Concert music rang from two enormous speakers outside the shop. I knew the music, Bach's Sonata for Piano and Violin, number 4, and I was drawn towards it as keenly as if someone were pulling me by the hand. The counterpoint, holding together composer, musicians, and even silence, the music, with its spiraling waves of grief and rapture, was everything I remembered. Dizzy, I leaned against the glass. And suddenly, I was in the car with my father. I heard rain splashing up over the tires, and my father humming. He was so alive, so beloved, that the incomprehensibility of his suicide grieved me all over again. By then, my father had been dead for 2 decades, and such a pure memory of him had never come back to me. I was 31 years old. I went inside the store. The pianist, Glenn Gould, appeared on a flat screen. He and Yehudi Menuhin were performing the Bach Sonata I had recognized. There was Glenn Gould, hunched over the piano, wearing a dark suit, hearing patterns far beyond the range of what most of us are given to perceive. And he was so familiar to me, like an entire language, a world I had forgotten. In 1989, life had become a set of necessary routines for my mother and me. Work and school, television, food, sleep. My father's first departure happened at the same time as momentous events occurring in China, events which my mother watched obsessively on CNN. I asked her who these protesters were, and she said they were students and everyday people. I asked if my father was there, and she said, "No, it's Tiananmen Square in Beijing." The demonstrations, bringing over a million Chinese citizens into the streets, had begun in April, when my father still lived with us, and continued after he disappeared to Hong Kong. Then, on June 4th, and in the days and weeks following the massacre, my mother wept. I watched her night after night. Ba had defected from China in 1978 and was forbidden from re-entering the country. But my incomprehension attached itself to the things I could see, those chaotic, frightening images of people and tanks and my mother in front of the screen. That summer, as if in a dream, I continued my calligraphy lessons at the nearby cultural center, using brush and ink to copy line after line of Chinese poetry. But the words I could recognize, big, small, girl, moon, sky, da, xiao, nü, yue, tian, were few. My father spoke Mandarin and my mother Cantonese, but I was fluent only in English. At first, the puzzle of the Chinese language had seemed a game, a pleasure, but my inability to understand began to trouble me. Over and over, I wrote characters I couldn't read, making them bigger and bigger until excess ink soaked the flimsy paper and tore it. I didn't care. I stopped going. In October, two police officers came to our door. They informed my mother that Ba was gone, and that the coroner's office in Hong Kong would handle the file. They said Ba's death was a suicide. Then, quiet, Qi became another person living inside our house. It slept in the closet with my father's shirts, trousers, and shoes. It guarded his Beethoven, Prokofiev, and Shostakovich scores, his hats, armchair, and special cup. Quiet, Qi moved into our minds and stormed like an ocean inside my mother and me. That winter, Vancouver was even more gray and wet than usual, as if the rain was a thick sweater we couldn't remove. I fell asleep certain that in the morning, Ba would wake me as he always had, his voice tugging me from sleep, until this delusion compounded the loss and hurt more than what had come before. Weeks crept by, and 1989 disappeared inside 1990. Ma and I ate dinner on the sofa every night, because there was no space on our dining table. My father's official documents, certificates of various kinds, tax declarations, had already been organized, but the odds and ends persisted. As Ma investigated the apartment more thoroughly, other bits of paper came to light. Music scores, a handful of letters my father had written but never sent. Sparrow, I do not know if this letter will reach you, but... And ever more notebooks. As I watched these items increase, I imagined my mother believed that Ba would reincarnate as a piece of paper. Or maybe she believed, as the ancients did, that words written on paper were talismans and could somehow protect us from harm. Most nights, Ma would sit among them, still in her office clothes. I tried not to bother her. I stayed in the adjoining living room and heard, now and then, the nearly soundless turning of pages. The chi of her breathing. Rain exploding and slicing down the window panes. We were suspended in time. Over and over, the number 29 electric bus clattered past. I fantasized conversations. I tried to imagine Ba reborn in the underworld, buying another new diary, using a different currency, and slipping his change into a new coat pocket. A lightweight coat, made of feathers, or maybe a cloak of camel wool, a coat sturdy enough for both heaven and the underworld. Meanwhile, my mother distracted herself by trying to find my father's family, wherever they might be, to tell them that their long-lost son or brother or uncle no longer survived in this world. She began searching for Ba's adoptive father, a man who had once lived in Shanghai and had been known as the Professor. He was the only family Ba had ever mentioned. The search for information was slow and painstaking. There was no email or internet back then, and so it was easy for Ma to send a letter, but difficult to obtain a true answer. My father had left China a long time ago, and if the professor were still alive, he would be a supremely old man. The Beijing we saw on television, with mortuaries and grieving families, with tanks stationed at the intersections, bristling with rifles, was a world away from the Beijing my father had known. And yet, I sometimes think, not so different after all. It was a few months later, in March 1990, that my mother showed me the Book of Records. That night, Ma was seated at her usual place at the dining table, reading. The notebook in her hand was tall and narrow, the dimensions of a miniature door. It had a loose binding of walnut-colored cotton string. Long past my bedtime, Ma suddenly noticed me. "What's wrong with you?" she said, and then, confused by her own question, "Have you finished your homework? What time is it?" I'd finished ages ago and had been watching a horror movie on mute. I still remember a man had just been killed with an ice pick. "It's midnight," I said, disturbed, because the man had been soft as dough. My mother extended a hand, and I went to her. She closed one arm around my waist and squeezed. "Do you want to see what I'm reading?" I leaned over the notebook and stared at the gathering of words. Chinese characters tracked down the page like animal prints in the snow.
"It's a story,"
Ma said. "Oh, what kind of story?"
"I think it's a novel. There's an adventurer named Da Wei who sets sail to America, and a heroine named May 4th who walks across the Gobi Desert."
I stared harder, but the words remained unreadable.
"There was a time when people copied out entire books by hand," Ma said. "The Russians called it samizdat. The Chinese called it, well, I don't think we have a name. Look how dirty this notebook is. There's even bits of grass on it. Goodness knows how many people carried it all over the place. It's decades older than you, Li Ling."
I wondered, what wasn't? I asked if this notebook had been copied by Ba. My mother shook her head. She said the handwriting was beautiful, the work of a refined calligrapher, while my father's writing was only so-so.
"This notebook is one chapter from something longer. Here it says, number 17. It doesn't say who the author is, but look, here's a title. The Book of Records."
She set the notebook down. On the dining table, my father's papers had the appearance of white caps surging forward, about to crest off the surface and explode onto the carpet. All our mail was here, too. Since the new year, Ma had begun receiving letters from Beijing, condolences from musicians in the Central Philharmonic who had only lately learned of my father's death. Ma read these letters with a dictionary at hand, because the letters were written in simplified Chinese, which she had never learned. Educated in Hong Kong, my mother had studied the traditional Chinese script, but on the mainland, in the 1950s, a new, simpler script had become law in communist China. Thousands of words had changed. For instance, to write, xie, went from the traditional xie to the simplified xie. and to know, 十, went from the traditional 十 to the simplified 十. Even Communist Party, 共产党, went from the traditional 共产党 to the simplified 共产党. Sometimes Ma could see the word's former self. Other times, she guessed at meanings. She said it was like reading a letter from the future, or talking to someone who had turned their back on her. All this was complicated by the fact that she rarely read in Chinese anymore, and expressed most of her thoughts in English. She didn't like my speaking Cantonese because, as she said, "Your accent is completely crooked."
"It's cold in here," I whispered. "Let's put on our pajamas and go to bed."
Ma stared at the notebook, not even half listening.
"Mother will be tired in the morning," I persisted.
"Mother will hit snooze 20 times. She smiled, but her eyes beneath her glasses tightened against something.
"Go to bed," she said. "Don't wait up for mother."
I kissed her soft cheek. She said,
"What did the Buddhist say to the pizza maker?"
"What?"
"Make me one with everything."
I laughed and groaned and laughed again, then shivered, thinking of the victim on the television, his doughy skin. Smiling, she nudged me firmly away. Lying in bed, I considered several facts. First, that in my grade 5 class, I was an entirely different person. I was so good-natured and well-adjusted there, so high-achieving, I wondered if my brain and soul were separating. Second, that in poorer countries, people like Ma and me would not be so lonely. On television, poor countries were crowded places, overloaded elevators trying to rise to the sky. People slept 6 to a bed, 12 to a room. There you could always speak your thoughts out loud, assured that someone would hear you, even if they didn't want to. In fact, the way to punish someone might be to remove them from their circle of family and friends, isolate them in a cold country, and shatter them with loneliness. Third, and this was not a fact but a question, why had our love meant so little to Ba? I must have slept because I woke abruptly to see Ma leaning over me. Her fingertips wiped my face. I never cried in the daytime, only at night.
"Don't be like this, Li Ling," she said.
She was mumbling a lot of things. She said,
"If you're trapped in a room and nobody is coming to save you, what can you do? You have to bang on the walls and break the windows. You have to climb out and save yourself. It's obvious, Li Ling, that crying doesn't help a person live."
"My name is Marie," I shouted. "Marie!" She smiled.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Li Ling."
"Your girl."
She used my father's pet name for me, because the word "女" meant both girl and daughter. He liked to joke that where he came from, the poor didn't bother to name their daughters. Ma would smack his shoulder and say in Cantonese,
"Don't fill her head like a garbage can."
Protected in her arms, I curled once more toward sleep. Later, I woke to the sound of Ma mumbling run-on thoughts, and she was cackling. These winter mornings were so lightless, but Ma's unexpected laugh cut through the room like buzzing from the electric heater. Her skin had the fragrance of clean pillows, of the sweet osmanthus cream that she used. When I whispered her name, she mumbled, and then, I asked her, "Are you walking on land or in the sea?" Very distinctly, she said,
"He's here."
Who? I tried to see into the darkness of the room. I truly believed that he was here.
Adoptive man. That professor.
I held tight to her fingers. On the other side of the curtains, the sky was changing color. I wanted to follow her into my father's past, and yet I didn't trust it. People could walk away towards illusions. They might see something so entrancing they would neglect to turn around. I feared that, like my father, she would no longer remember the reasons for coming home. Life outside, the start of a new school year, the regularity of tests, the pleasures of math camp, continued as if it would never cease, driven forward by the circular world of seasons. My father's summer and winter coats still waited beside the door, beneath his hats and above his shoes. In early December, a thick envelope arrived from Shanghai, and Ma once again sat down with her dictionary. The dictionary is a small format, extremely fat hardback, with a green and white cover. The pages, as I turned them, are diaphanous and seem to weigh nothing. Here and there I find a spot of grease or a ring of coffee from my mother's cup, or perhaps my own. Each word is filed under its root, also known as a radical. For instance, men means gate. But it's also a radical, that is, the building block for other words and concepts. If light, or the sun, ri, shines through the gate, we have space, jian. If there is a horse, ma, inside the gate, this is an ambush, chuang. And if there is a mouth, ko, inside the gate, we have a question, wen. If there is an eye, mu, and a dog, qian, inside, we have quiet, qu. The letter from Shanghai was 30 pages long and written in a spidery hand. After some minutes, I tired of watching my mother struggle through it. I went to the front room and gazed at the neighbors. Across the courtyard, I saw a miserable Christmas tree. It looked like someone had tried to strangle it with tinsel. Rain gusted, and the wind whistled. I brought my mother a glass of eggnog. Is it a good letter? Ma set the pages down. Her eyelids looked swollen.
It's not what I expected.
I ran my finger across the envelope and began to decipher the name on the return address. It surprised me. A woman? I asked, suddenly afraid. My mother nodded.
She has a request,
Ma said, taking the envelope from me and shoving it beneath some papers. I moved closer, as if she was a vase about to slide off the table. But Ma's puffy eyes conveyed an unexpected emotion. Comfort? Or maybe, and to my astonishment, joy? Ma continued.
She's asking for a favor.
Will you read the letter to me? Ma pinched the bridge of her own nose.
Oh, the whole thing is really long. She says she hasn't seen your father in many years, but once they were like family.
She hesitated on the word family.
She says her husband was your father's composition teacher at the Shanghai Conservatory of Music. But they lost touch with one another during the difficult years.
What difficult years? I began to suspect that any favor would involve American dollars or a new refrigerator, and feared that Ma would be taken advantage of.
Before you were born, the 1960s, back when your father was a music student.
Ma looked down with an unreadable expression.
She says that your father made contact with them last year. Ba wrote to her from Hong Kong a few days before he died.
A string of questions rose in me. I knew I shouldn't pester her, but at last, because I wished only to understand, I said, "Who is she? What's her name?"
"Her surname is Deng."
"But her given name?" Ma opened her mouth, but no words came out. Finally, she looked me straight in the eye and said,
"Her given name is Li Ling."
She had the same name as me, only it had been written in simplified Chinese. I reached for the letter. Ma put her hand firmly over mine. Forestalling my next question, she lunged ahead.
"These 30 pages are about the present, not the past. Deng Liling's daughter arrived in Toronto, but her passport can't be used. Her daughter has nowhere to go. She needs our help. Her daughter..."
Nimbly, Ma slid the letter into its envelope.
"Her daughter will come and live with us for a little while. Do you understand? This letter is about the present."
I felt sideways and upside down. Why would a stranger live with us?
"Her daughter's name is Ai Ming," Ma said, trying to lead me back. "I'm going to telephone now and arrange for her to come."
"Are we the same age?" Ma looked confused.
"No, she must be at least 19 years old. She's a student. Deng Liling says that her daughter, she says that Ai Ming, got into trouble in Beijing during the Tiananmen demonstrations. She ran away."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Enough,"
my mother said.
"That's all you need to know."
"No, I need to know more." Exasperated, Ma slammed the dictionary shut.
"Who brought you up? You're too young to be this nosy."
"But..."
"Enough."
Ma waited until I was in bed before she made the telephone call. She spoke in her mother tongue, Cantonese, with brief interjections of Mandarin, and I could hear, even through the closed door, how she hesitated over the tones which had never come naturally to her.
"Is it very cold where you are?"
I heard Ma say. And then,
"The Greyhound ticket will be waiting for you at..."
I took off my glasses and stared out the blurred window. Rain appeared like snow. Ma's voice sounded foreign to me. After a long period of silence, I rehooked my glasses over my ears, climbed out of bed, and went out. Ma had a pen in her hand and a stack of bills before her, as if waiting for dictation. She saw me and said,
"Where are your slippers?"
I said, "Didn't know." Ma exploded.
"Go to bed, girl. Why can't you understand? I just want some peace. You never leave me alone. You watch me and watch me as if you think I'll..."
She slapped the pen down. Some piece of it snapped off and ran along the floor.
"You think I'm going to leave? You think I'm as selfish as he is? That I would ever abandon you and hurt you like he did?"
There was a long, violent outburst in Cantonese, then,
"Just go to bed."
She looked so aged and fragile sitting there, with her old, heavy dictionary. I fled to the bathroom, slammed the door, opened it, slammed it harder, and burst into tears. I ran water in the tub, realizing that what I really wanted was, in fact, to go to bed. My sobs turned to hiccups, and when the hiccups finally stopped, all I heard was water gushing down. Perched on the edge of the tub, I watched my feet distort beneath the surface, my pale legs folded away as I submerged. Ba, in my memory, came back to me. He pushed a cassette into a tape player, told me to roll down the windows and sail down Main Street and along Great Northern Way, blaring Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, performed by Glenn Gould, with Leopold Stokowski conducting. Tumbling notes cascaded down and infinitely up, and my father conducted with his right hand while steering with his left. I heard his humming melodic and percussive, da da di 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 da 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 da. I had the sensation that, as we paraded triumphantly across Vancouver, the first movement was being created not by Beethoven, but by my father. His hand moved in the shape of 4/4 time, the cliff-hanging thrill between the fourth beat and the first. 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I wondered what it could mean that a man who had once been famous, who had performed in Beijing before Mao Zedong himself, did not even keep a piano in his own home, that he made his living by working in a shop. In fact, though I begged for violin lessons, my father always said no. And yet here we were, crossing the city, embraced by this victorious music, so that the past, Beethoven's and my father's, was never dead, but only reverberated beneath the windshield, then rose and covered us like the sun. The Buick was gone. Ma had sold it. She had always been the tougher one, like the cactus in the living room, the only houseplant to survive Ba's departure. To live, my father had needed more. The bathwater lapped over me. Embarrassed by the waste, I wrenched the tap closed. My father had once said that music was full of silences. He had left nothing for me. No letter, no message, not a word. Ma knocked at the door.
"Marie,"
she said. She turned the handle, but it was locked.
"Li Ling, are you okay?"
A long moment passed. The truth was that I had loved my father more. The realization came to me in the same breath I knew, unquestionably, that my father must have been in great pain, and that my mother would never, ever abandon me. She, too, had loved him. Weeping, I rested my hands on the surface of the water. "I just needed to take a bath."
"Oh,"
she said. Her voice seemed to echo inside the tub itself.
"Don't get cold in there."
She tried the door again, but it was still locked.
"We'll be okay,"
she said, finally. I wanted, more than anything, to wake us both from this dream. Instead, helplessly, I splashed water over my tears and nodded. "I know." I listened to the sound of her slippers diminish as they padded away. On the 16th of December, 1990, Ma came home in a taxi with a new daughter, who wore no coat, only a thick scarf, a woolen sweater, blue jeans, and canvas shoes. I had never met a Chinese girl before, that is, one who, like my father, came from real mainland China. A pair of gray mittens dangled from a string around her neck and swayed in nervous rhythm against her legs. The fringed ends of her blue scarf fell one in front and one behind, like a scholar. The rain was falling hard, and she walked with her head down, holding a medium-sized suitcase that appeared to be empty. She was pale, and her hair had the gleam of the sea. Casually, I opened the door and widened my eyes, as if I was not expecting visitors.
"Girl," Ma said, "take the suitcase. Hurry up."
Ai Ming stepped inside and paused on the edge of the doormat. When I reached for the suitcase, my hand accidentally touched hers, but she didn't draw back. Instead, her other hand reached out and lightly covered mine.
She gazed right at me, with such openness and curiosity that, out of shyness, I closed my eyes.
"Ai Ming,"
Ma was saying,
"let me introduce you. This is my girl."
I pulled away and opened my eyes again. Ma, taking off her coat, glanced first at me and then at the room. The brown sofa with its three camel-colored stripes had seen better days, but I had spruced it up with all the flowery pillows and stuffed animals from my bed. I had also turned on the television in order to give this room the appearance of liveliness. Ma nodded vigorously at me.
"Girl, greet your aunt."
"Really, it's okay if you call me Ai Ming. Please, I really, prefer it." To placate them both, I said, "Hello." Just as I suspected, the suitcase was very light. With my free hand, I moved to take Ai Ming's coat, remembering too late she didn't have one. My arm wavered in the air like a question mark. She reached out, grasped my hand, and firmly shook it. She had a question in her eyes. Her hair, pinned back on one side, fell loosely on the other, so that she seemed forever in profile, about to turn towards me. Without letting go of my hand, she maneuvered her shoes noiselessly off her feet, first one, then the other. Pinpoints of rain glimmered on her scarf. Our lives had contracted to such a degree that I could not remember the last time a stranger had entered our home. Ai Ming's presence made everything unfamiliar, as if the walls were crowding a few inches nearer to see her. The previous night, we had, at last, tidied Ba's papers and notebooks, putting them into boxes and stacking the boxes under the kitchen table. Now I found the table surface deceitfully bare. I freed my hand, saying I would put the suitcase in her bedroom. Ma showed her around the apartment. I retreated to the sofa and pretended to watch the weather channel, which predicted rain for the rest of the week, the rest of 1990, the rest of the century, and even the remainder of all time. Their two voices ran one after the other like cable cars, interrupted now and then by silence. The intensity in the apartment crept inside me, and I had the sensation that the floor was made of paper, that there were words written everywhere I couldn't read, and one unthinking gesture could crumple this whole place down. We ate together, seated around the dining table. Ma had removed a leaf, transforming the table from an egg to a circle. She interrupted her own rambling to give me a look that said, "Stop staring." Every now and then my foot accidentally kicked one of the boxes under the table, causing Ai Ming to startle.
"Ai Ming, do you mind the cold?"
Ma said cheerily, ignoring me.
"I myself never experienced winter until I came to Canada."
"Beijing has winter, but I didn't mind it. Actually, I grew up far away from there, in the south, where it was humid and warm. And so when we moved to Beijing, the cold was new to me."
"Oh, I've never been to the capital, but I heard the dust flies in from the western deserts."
"Ah, it's true." Ai Ming nodded, smiling. "The dust would get into our clothes and hair, and even into our food." Sitting across from her, I could see that she really was 19. Her eyes looked puffy and exhausted, and reminded me unexpectedly of Ma's grieving face. Sometimes I think you can look at a person and know they are full of words. Maybe the words are withheld due to pain or privacy, or maybe subterfuge. Maybe there are knife-edged words waiting to draw blood. I felt like both a child and a grown-up. I wanted Ma and me to be left alone, but for reasons I couldn't explain, I wanted to be near her.
"What is the Ming of I Ming?" I asked in English, kicking a box for emphasis. "Is it the Ming that means to understand, or the Ming that means fate?" They both looked at me.
"Eat your chicken," Ma said.
The daughter studied me, a pleased expression on her face. She drew a shape in the air between us. Ming. The sun and the moon combined to make understanding, or brightness. It was an everyday word.
"My parents wanted the idea of I Ming," she said, "to cherish wisdom. But you're right, there's a misgiving in it. An idea that is, not cherishing fate. Not quite, but accepting it."
She picked up her bowl again and pushed the tip of her chopsticks into the softness of the rice. Ma asked her if there was anything she needed or if there was something she would like to do. I Ming put down her bowl.
"To be honest, I feel as if it's been a long time since I had a good night's sleep. In Toronto, I couldn't rest. Every few weeks, I had to move."
"Move house?"
Ma said. I Ming was trembling.
"I thought I was afraid of the police. I was frightened they would send me back. I don't know if my mother was able to tell you everything. I hope so. In Beijing, I didn't do anything wrong, anything criminal, but even so. In China, my aunt and uncle helped me leave, and I crossed the border into Kyrgyzstan. And then you bought my ticket here. Despite everything, you helped me. I'm grateful. I'm afraid I'll never be able to thank you as I should. I'm sorry for everything."
Ma looked embarrassed.
"Here," she said, "eat something."
But a change had come over I Ming. Her hands were shaking so hard, she couldn't manage her chopsticks.
"Every day, I go back and think things over, but I can't understand how I arrived here. It's as if I'm a fugitive. At home, my mother is struggling. I'm afraid to sleep. Sometimes I dream that none of this really happened, but then waking up becomes a nightmare. If my mother had me with her, if only my father was alive, if only he hadn't... But the most important thing is that I make something of myself, because right now I have nothing. I haven't even got a passport. I'm afraid to use the one I had before. It's not legal. It wasn't mine, but I had no choice. I heard that if I could get across the border into the United States, there's an amnesty for Chinese students, and I might qualify. Even if I have nothing, I'll pay everything back, I swear it. I promise."
"Zhinyu,"
Ma said, leaning towards her. The words confused me. They meant my brother's daughter. But Ma had no brothers. "I wanted to take care of them, but everything changed so quickly. Everything went wrong."
"There's no need to defend yourself here," Ma said. "We're family, and these are not just words. Do you understand? These are much more than words."
"And also," I Ming said, turning pale, "I'm truly sorry for your loss." My mother and I Ming looked at each other.
"Thank you,"
Ma said. The sudden tears in her eyes stilled everything inside me. Despite all we had been through, my mother rarely wept.
"And I'm so sorry for yours. My husband loved your father very much."
On the first Saturday that Ma didn't have to work, she went downtown and came home with socks, sweaters, a pair of winter shoes, and a coat. In the beginning, I Ming slept a great deal.
She would emerge from Ma's bedroom with jumbled hair, wearing a pair of my leggings and an old T-shirt of Ma's. Aiming was afraid to go outside, so weeks passed before she wore the new shoes. The coat, however, she wore every day. In the afternoons, she read a lot. Sitting at the kitchen table with a stack of my father's books, she read with her hands in her coat pockets and used a cleaver to keep the book flat. Her hair sometimes slid forward and blocked the light, and she would wind it up and tuck the bundle inside the neck of her sweater. One night, after she had been with us about a week, she asked Ma to cut her hair. It was just after Christmas, I remember. Since school was out, I spent most of my time eating chocolate turtles in front of the television. Ma ordered me to come and spray Aiming's hair with water from the plastic bottle, but I refused, saying that our guest's hair should be left alone. The women laughed. Aiming said she wanted to look modern. They went into the kitchen and laid down sheets of newspaper, and Aiming removed her coat and climbed up onto a footstool so that her long hair could fall freely into Ma's scissors. I was watching an episode of the A-Team, and the cold swish of the scissors, as well as their giggling, made it impossible to concentrate. At the first commercial break, I went into the kitchen to check their progress. Aiming, hands folded as if she were praying, rolled her eyes towards me. Ma had cut about a third of her hair, and the long wet ends lay on the floor like massacred sea creatures.
"Oh," I said, "how could you?"
Ma lifted her weapon.
"Your next girl."
"Mali, it's almost the new year. Time for a haircut." Aiming had difficulty saying Marie, and so had chosen the Chinese variant, which, according to the dictionary, meant charming mineral. Just then, Ma detached another sizable chunk of hair. It fluttered, as if still breathing, to the floor.
"It's Canadian New Year. People in Canada don't get haircuts at New Year's. They drink champagne."
Each time Ma pulled the trigger of the plastic bottle, a fine mist shrouded Aiming, who squeezed her eyes tight against the cold. As I watched, Aiming transformed before my eyes. Even the pallor of her skin began to seem less dire. When she had cut to shoulder length, Ma began shaping bangs that slanted across Aiming's forehead in a decidedly chic way. She was very, very beautiful. Her eyes were dark and unclouded, and the shape of her mouth was, just as the poets say, a rose against her skin. There was a flush to Aiming's cheeks that had not been there an hour before, color that rose each time Ma gazed at her for long moments, assessing her handiwork. They had forgotten all about me. When I went back to the other room, the credits were rolling on the A-Team. I collapsed on the couch and pulled my knees up to my chest. Festive lights shone in almost every window but ours, and I had the sensation that our apartment was under scrutiny by residents of a UFO, unsure whether to land in Vancouver or fly on. The aliens in my spaceship were asking themselves, do they have soda? What kind of food do they eat? Maybe we should wait and return in spring. Land, I told them. People aren't made to float through the air. Unless we know the weight of our bodies, unless we feel the force of gravity, we'll forget what we are. We'll lose ourselves without even noticing. Aiming had been reading one of my father's bilingual poetry books. I picked it up now, a book familiar to me because I had used it in my calligraphy lessons. I paged through it until I came to a poem I knew, words my father had underlined. "Watch little by little the night turn around. Echoes in the house. Want to go up, dare not. A glow behind the screen. Wish to go through. Cannot. It would hurt too much to see the swallow on her hairpin. Truly shame me, to see the phoenix in her mirror. To Hengtang I return at dawn, fading like light on a jeweled saddle. I read the poem twice through and closed the book. I hoped that my father, in the afterlife to which he had gone, was also celebrating Christmas and the new year. But I feared that he was alone, and that, unlike Ai Ming, he had not yet found a family to protect him. Despite my anger at him, despite the pain that wouldn't leave me, I could not shake my longing for his happiness. It was inevitable, of course, that Ai Ming would discover the boxes under the table. In January, I came home from school and found my father's papers completely exposed, not because she had moved them, but because she had pushed the dining table backwards. One of the boxes had been completely emptied. Ba's diaries spread across the table reminded me of the poverty of the Vancouver flea market. Worse, Ai Ming could read every character, while I, his only daughter, couldn't read a single line. She was making cabbage salad, and had grated so much horseradish that I wondered whether the cabbage would actually fit. I said that I didn't know if my stomach could handle that much horseradish. She nodded distractedly and flung the cabbage in, tossing it wildly. Everything flew up in the air and rained down into the bowl. Ai Ming was wearing Ma's Canada the World Next Door apron, and her winter coat underneath. She went to the table. "Once, when I was very small, I met your father." I remained where I was. Ai Ming and I had never spoken about Ba. That she had known him, that she had never thought to mention this to me before, filled me with a disappointment so intense I could hardly breathe. "This afternoon," she said, "I started looking inside these boxes. These are your father's things, aren't they? Of course I knew I should ask your permission, but there were so many notebooks." I answered without looking at her. "My father moved to Canada in 1979. That's 12 years of papers. A whole life. He hardly left us anything."
"I call this the room of zaji," she said. "The things that don't fit. Bits and pieces."
Inside my head, to calm the shivering that had started in my chest and was now radiating to my limbs, I repeated over and over the words Ai Ming had used, but which I had never heard before. Zha ji.
"You understand, don't you?" she said. "The things we never say aloud, and so they end up here, in diaries and notebooks, in private places. By the time we discover them, it's too late."
Ai Ming was holding a notebook tightly. I recognized it at once. It was tall but thin, the shape of a miniature door, with a loose binding of cotton thread. The Book of Records.
"So you've seen this before?"
When I still didn't answer, she smiled sadly at me.
"This is my father's handwriting. You see, his writing is so effortless, so artful. He always wrote with care, even if the character was an easy one. It was his nature to be attentive."
She opened the notebook. The words seemed to float on the surface and move of their own accord. I backed away. She didn't need to show me. I knew what it looked like.
"I have my own zaji," she continued. "But it's everywhere now, and I don't know how to contain it. Do you know why we keep records, Ma Li? There must be a reason, but what good does it do to keep such insignificant things? My father was a great composer, a great musician, but he gave up his talents so that he could protect me. He was an upright and sincere person, and even your father wanted to keep a part of him. Even your father loved him.
but they let him die. They killed him as if he were an animal. How can anyone explain this to me? If my father were alive, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be alone. And your father, he wouldn't have... Oh, Mali, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Ai Ming did something I had not seen her do since her arrival more than a month ago. Not only did she weep, but she was too overcome to turn away or cover her face. The sound disturbed me so much, a low keening that dismantled everything. I thought she was saying, "Help me, help me." I was terrified that if I touched her, her pain would swell inside my body and become my own forever. I couldn't bear it. I turned away from her. I went into my bedroom and closed the door. The room felt very small. "Family," I whispered to myself, "was a precious box that could not open and close at will just because Ma said so." Ba's picture on my dresser hurt me so much. Now, it wasn't the picture of him, but the feeling it caused, this chafing emotion that turned everything, even my love for Ma and Ai Ming, bitter. I wanted to throw the picture on the floor, but I was afraid that it was real, that it contained my father himself, and if I damaged it, he would never be able to come home. The rain outside hammered against my thoughts. Down the window pane, it changed and slipped, and all those rivulets of water, growing large and small, joining and shivering, began to confuse and mesmerize me. Was I as insignificant as that? Would I ever change anything? I suddenly remembered the scent of my father, a sweetness like new leaves or freshly mown grass, the smell of his soap, his voice with its oddly formal syntax.
"What does daughter wish to say to father? Why is daughter crying?"
His voice, like no voice that had ever lived. I remembered against my will how I'd overheard Ma saying that when Ba was found, he'd had almost no belongings. She'd been speaking on the telephone long distance to a friend in Hong Kong. She said that the suitcase, full when he left, was empty. He'd gotten rid of everything, including his wedding ring, his Sony portable CD player, and his music. He hadn't even been carrying a photograph of us. The only note he left was not a goodbye. All it said was that there were debts he couldn't pay, failures he couldn't live with, and that he wished to be buried in Hong Kong at the Chinese border. He said that he loved us. Once each year, my father used to take us to the symphony. We never had good seats, but Ba said it didn't matter. The point was to be there, to exist in the room while music, however old it might be, was being renewed. Life was full of obstacles. My father used to tell me, and no one could be sure that tomorrow or next year anything would remain the same. He told me that when he was a young boy, his adoptive father, the professor, had gone with him to the symphony in Shanghai, and that the experience had changed him forever. Inside him, walls that he had never realized existed suddenly revealed themselves.
"I knew I was destined to have a different kind of life," he said.
Once he became aware of these walls, all he could think about was how to pull them down. "What walls?" I had asked.
"Ming," he said. "Fate."
It was only later, when I looked up the word again, that I saw that Ming meant fate, but it also meant life. The knock on the door brought me back to the rain, to the room, and myself.
"Mali,"
Ai Ming began, sitting at the foot of my bed.
She had turned the desk lamp on, and she looked like a pale shadow I had cast.